if you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Lecture.
Sheikh Tahir Reza Jaffer.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. فقد قال أمير المؤمنين علي بن أبي طالب صلوات الله وسلامه عليه في خطبة له. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله الذي لبس العز والكبرياء واختارهما لنفسه دون خلقه وجعلهما حما وحرما على غيره واصطفاهما لجلاله وجعل اللعنة على من نازعه فيهما من عباده ثم اختبر بذلك ملائكته المقربين ليميز المتواضعين منهم من المستكبرين فقال سبحانه وهو العالم بمضمرات القلوب ومحجوبات الغيوب إني خالق بشرا من طين فإذا سويته ونفخت فيه من روحي فقعوا له ساجدين فسجد الملائكة كلهم أجمعون إلا إبليس اعترضته الحمية فافتخر على آدم بخلقه وتعصب عليه لأصله فعدو الله إمام المتعصبين وسلف المستكبرين الذي وضع أساس العصبية ونازع الله رداء الجبرية وادرع لباس التعزز وخلع قناع التذلل ألا ترون كيف صغره الله بتكبره ووضعه بترفعه فجعله في الدنيا مدحورا وأعد له في الآخرة سعيرا صلوات على محمد وآل محمد. Tonight we begin discussing the khutbah known as khutbatul qasi'ah. Two or three points about the khutbah before we begin. This is the longest khutbah in Nahjul Balagha. And the reason why it is known as qasi'ah is, well, the ulama have given seven different reasons for why it has been called qasi'ah. The word qasi'ah does not appear in the khutbah itself. And so there is debate, why is it called qasi'ah? We take one of the reasonings that was given to us by a contemporary scholar, Sheikh Makarim Shirazi, one of Maraji' Taqlid in Qum. He says that the reason why this khutbah has been called qasi'ah is that qasi'ah means something that is crushing, a crushing blow is called qasi'ah. And because Imam Ali alayhi salam in this khutbah, he delivers a crushing blow to Shaytan and the followers of Shaytan in the way that he describes Shaytan, in the way that he describes the followers of Shaytan. Therefore, it is known as Qasi'a. This is one of the reasons why it is named Qasi'a. Now, before we get into the khutbah itself, the context is very important. We need to know, when was this khutbah delivered and why was it delivered by Imam Ali alayhi salam? It is said that this khutbah was delivered during the final days of the Khilafah of Amir al-Mu'mineen in Kufa. It was a time when the wealth that had entered the Muslim Ummah and the influence that had entered the Muslim Ummah from neighboring lands had corrupted the young people in the society and had taken them back to their old jahili ways. At the time of Jahiliyyah, one of the practices was that they had a lot of asabiyya, they had a lot of bigotry, they had a lot of tribalism. Everyone was affiliated to their families and their tribes, and if anyone would attack one member of your tribe, the whole tribe would come in support of that person. If one person was killed by another tribe, then they would take revenge and kill two or three people. And so this was the prevailing atmosphere in Kufa. All this corruption had come into Kufa. And so the Imam alayhi salam, in this environment, he delivered this very powerful sermon, this very powerful khutbah, in order to mend the fractured society and the disunity in society, in order to remind the people that this practice of tribalism, this practice of asabiyya and hamiyya and arrogance and following the ways of shaitan and going back to the jahili practices, this is not what Islam teaches. This is the way of Iblis, of shaitan. And so it's a very beautiful khutbah. And what we have recited today, the first part of the khutbah, we will summarize for you inshallah. So from what we have recited today, the first part of this khutbah, it can be summarized into 4 points. The first point is that Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam is saying, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. That Allah Azza wa Jal has certain qualities that He has reserved for Himself, not to be shared with any of His creatures. He begins by saying, Alhamdulillahi alladhi labisa al-izza wal-kibriya wakhtarahuma linafsihi duna khalqih. All praise be to Allah who adorned Himself with majesty and grandeur. And He has kept these qualities exempt from the people, meaning that He has chosen them for Himself and has not allowed any of His creatures to go near these qualities. So there are certain qualities that Allah has chosen for Himself. That is point number one. Point number two is that Allah Azza wa Jal tested His angels. Very interesting. فَاخْتَبَرَ بِذَٰلِكَ مَلَائِكَتَهُ. Now that He has chosen these two qualities of majesty and grandeur for Himself, now He is testing His angels. فَاخْتَبَرَ مَلَائِكَتَهُ. Why? لِيُمَيِّزَ الْمُتَوَاضِعِينَ مِنْهُمْ مِنَ الْمُسْتَكْبِرِينَ. So that He can distinguish who amongst them are humble and who are arrogant. Subhanallah. Point number two. Point number three in the summary is that when Allah now gives this test to the malaika, what happens? All the malaika pass the test. Illa Iblis. Only Iblis fails. When he fails, what happens? Imam describes him, he says, فَعَدُوُ اللَّهِ. Now he is the enemy of Allah. إِمَامُ الْمُتَعَصِّبِينَ. The imam of the bigoted people. وسلف المستكبرين and the leader of the arrogant ones. This is the description of Iblis now that he has failed the test. And finally then the Imam says, what is the consequence of his failing the test? أَلَا تَرَوْنَا كَيْفَ صَغَّرَهُ اللَّهُ بِتَكَبُّرِهِ وَوَضَعَهُ بِتَرَفُعِهِ. Did you not see how Allah humiliated him because of his takabbur and arrogance? How he made him low because of his wanting to be higher? So that arrogance, that haughtiness of Iblis led him to become a humiliated person. In this dunya, we all say shaytanin rajim, the one who is stoned and chased away. We chase him away. And in the hereafter, Allah has prepared for him the fire of hell. So this is a summary of the first part of Al-Khutbatul Qasi'ah. Now, we want to derive three themes from this first part. The first theme concerns the qualities of Allah Azza wa Jal, the attributes of Allah Azza wa Jal. We know from Surah Al-Isra how Allah Azza wa Jal has beautiful names. At one time, Rasulullah Muhammad Mustafa sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he was in sajda near the holy Kaaba and he was reciting in sajda, Ya Rahmanu, Ya Rahmanu, Ya Rahman. So the Quraysh, the mushrikeen of Quraysh, when they heard him taking the name Ya Rahman, they said, Muhammad has two gods now, na'udhu billah. One is Allah and the other is Ar-Rahman. And the ayah was revealed in Surah Al-Isra that said, وَلِدْعُ اللَّهِ أَوِدْعُ الرَّحْمَانِ أَيَّنْ مَا تَدْعُوا فَلَهُ الْأَسْمَاءُ الْحُسْنَى. Whether you call upon Allah or you call upon Rahman, whichever of the names you use, Allah has many beautiful names. So Allah has beautiful names, we know that. However, from His beautiful names, which also tell us about His qualities, His attributes, there are some that are specifically for Allah Azza wa Jal and cannot be shared with anyone else. For example, one of his beautiful names is Al-Mutakabbir. Mutakabbir means the proud one. Allah is allowed to be proud. We are not allowed to be proud. Why? Because pride can only come to you if you are all perfect. We all have some mistakes in us, some faults in us, some errors in our judgment, some problems in our character. None of us can say that we are all perfect. And because therefore you are not all perfect, then why are you proud? So he is Al-Mutakabbir, we cannot be Mutakabbir. Another example, he is Al-Jabbar, the one who dominates. We cannot be Jabbar. If we try to be Jabbar, we become tyrants. No. Why? Only Allah can be Jabbar. Because if you want to be Jabbar, you have to have the quality of perfect justice. Only Allah is perfectly just. So he can be Jabbar, but we cannot be Jabbar. There are other qualities that Allah has, other names that he has, that we can also try and emulate to our level, at our level. For example, one of his beautiful names is Al-Afu, the one who forgives. We also should be people who forgive. In the Quran, we are told, وَلْيَعْفُوا وَلْيَصْفَحُوا أَلَا تُحِبُّونَ أَنْ يَغْفِرَ اللَّهُ لَكُمْ. Let the people forgive one another. Let them pardon one another. Do you not want Allah also to forgive you? That means the quality of afu is one that we can also espouse. We can also emulate to our level. Of course, our afu can never be like the afu of Allah Azza wa Jal. But we learn from that. So there are some qualities, therefore, that are specifically for him, as we saw in this khutbah. The Imam mentions Al-Izz wal-Kibriya, majesty and grandeur. These are only for Allah, not to be shared with anyone. That is theme number one. Theme number two is angels. What a beautiful discussion on angels. When we look at angels, do you know that it is a fundamental part of our faith to believe in angels? If you do not believe in angels, there is a problem with your aqeedah. The Holy Quran tells us so in Surah An-Nisa, verse 136. وَمَنْ يَكْفُرْ بِاللَّهِ وَمَلَائِكَتِهِ وَكُتُبِهِ وَرُسُلِهِ وَالْيَوْمِ الْآخِرِ فَقَدْ ضَلَّ ضَلَالًا بَعِيدًا. Whoever disbelieves in Allah and His angels and His books and His prophets and the last day, that means that the same way you believe in Allah and His prophets and His books and the last day, you must also believe in angels. Now, it is very beautiful when we talk about angels, we find that throughout history, the belief that people have had regarding angels, there are many divergent beliefs. There's a lot of deviation amongst people in general when it comes to angels. For example, the Arabs used to believe that angels were the daughters of God, the daughters of Allah, the children of Allah. And they said Allah or God to them is too lofty to be reached directly. So you have to go through the angels. So they would worship the angels. The Arabs at the time of Jahiliyyah, they used to worship the angels. This is one deviant belief about angels. Another example of deviant beliefs about angels is regarding some of the Jews at that time. Some of the Jews at that time actually went and started cursing Jibreel alayhi salam for bringing revelation on the Holy Prophet. Jibreel, he's our angel. He belongs to our God. How did he bring revelation to this prophet, the Arab prophet? And they started speaking ill against Jibreel. And then the ayah comes down and it rebukes these people in Surah Al-Baqarah, verse number 98. Man kana aduwan lillahi wa malaikatihi wa rusulihi wa jibreela wa mikala. فَإِنَّ اللَّهَ عَدُوٌ لِلْكَافِرِينَ. Whoever is an enemy of Allah and His prophets and His angels and Jibreel specifically and Mikael specifically, then Allah is the enemies of the disbelievers. That means that this group were enemies to these angels. Another example of deviant beliefs regarding angels, when we enter into the fold of Islam, we find that there were some people, some commentators, who, when they looked into the Quran and they saw malaika, they understood it to be something metaphorical. They said, we can't see any malaika. What is this malaika? What are these angels? It is only a metaphor for human consciousness. Angels, according to who? According to scholars like Muhammad Asad, who died in 1992, or Ghulam Ahmad Parvez, who died in 85, not very long ago. You find in their commentaries of the Quran, they say angels are just metaphors for human states of consciousness. They are not actual beings. So this is also an example of a deviant understanding of angels. But when we turn to our traditions and we ask about the nature of angels, we find it is very beautiful indeed. Allah. When you look at the nature of malaika, you find that at times the malaika would come on earth in the form of human beings. It is there in the Holy Quran, is it not? When these two handsome men come to Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam. And you know Prophet Ibrahim was Kareem. He was so generous. It is said in the traditions that he would never eat any meal alone. Now these two handsome men come to his house and he slaughters for them a heavy calf, ajlin sameen, you know. He roasts a calf for them and he brings it in front of them and these two handsome men don't eat. At that moment there was a sense of trepidation in the heart of Ibrahim alayhi salam. What is happening? Why are they not eating? And at that time, then the angel said that we are angels from Allah Azza wa Jalla. We have been sent to the community of Lut. We are bringing the azab on the community of Lut. They had come in the form of human beings. Even when they went to Lut's community and the people of Lut saw them, they thought these are ordinary human beings. But they were angels from Allah Azza wa Jalla. Look at the story of Maryam alayha salam. When the angel comes to her, he comes in the form of a beautiful, handsome man. That's what the Quran tells us. Basharan sawiyya. Sawiyya means, mashallah, well proportioned. Well proportioned means handsome. He comes to Maryam in that state. And if you say, no, only Masoom can see the angel. No. The wife of Ibrahim also was given the news of the child when these two men came. The people of Lut were not Masoom. They saw them. They thought they were normal human beings. So when we look at the character of human beings, the first thing we see is that angels, at times, they come to earth in the form of human beings. And sometimes we cannot even recognize that they are angels. They look to us like human beings. The second thing, when it comes to the quality of angels and the nature of angels, we find that angels have different ranks and different functions. Some angels are from the Muqarrabin, the archangels, those who are very close to Allah Azza wa Jalla. Some are of a lower rank. They have different ranks. The first verse of Suratul Fatir describes the different ranks of angels using wings as a metaphor. Uli ajnihatin mathna wa thulatha wa ruba'. Some of the angels have two wings, some three, some four. The ulama say here wings means rank, degree, power, status. Some are of a higher status, some are of a lower status. And functions, they have different functions. Some are there to worship Allah. One angel is created in the state of ruku' and will remain forever in that ruku'. One is created in sajda, forever in that sajda. One angel is tasked with taking the souls. He becomes malakul maut. One angel is tasked with recording the deeds of human beings. One is tasked with questioning the grave. So different angels have different functions. Jibreel alayhi salam was given the responsibility of bringing wahi from Allah Azza wa Jal to our Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. So when we're looking at the nature of angels, this is the second thing. They are of different levels and degrees and ranks. Again, when we look at angels, we find that angels are more numerous than all the other creation of Allah Azza wa Jalla. The traditions tell us that there are so many angels. In fact, in this very gathering, there are more angels than human beings. Just think about it for a moment. If we were to take the traditions at face value, and we say that every human being has a guardian angel, according to traditions, has two angels recording his deeds, one good, one bad. So already each person who entered here came with three angels. And of course, such a gathering of mu'mineen is full of barakah. And so the angels also must be visiting for that, because when you recite salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad, اللهم صل على محمد. Automatically you are multiplying the presence of the
angels.
So the angels are more in number than all the other creation of Allah Azza wa Jalla. Then now we go into the very interesting question. What about intellect? Do angels have intellect? Yes. Angels have aql. And not only aql, but curiosity. They are curious, they want to know. They are always looking at human beings. Sometimes they laugh at us. Sometimes they cry when they see what we are doing. But they are curious also. When Allah Azza wa Jal said that I am going to make a khalifa on earth, what did they say? أَتَجْعَلُ فِيهَا مَنْ يُفْسِدُ فِيهَا وَيَسْفِكُ الدِّمَاءَ وَنَحْنُ نُسَبِّحُ بِحَمْدِكَ وَنُقَدِّسُ لَكَ. Oh Allah! Verse 30 of Surah Al-Baqarah, it says, Oh Allah, are you going to create that creature who is going to cause fasad and bloodshed on earth while we here are perpetually doing glorification, tasbih, tahmid? We are glorifying you, Allah. So in other words, if you take this ayah and you turn it around, it is like they're asking Allah, Oh Allah, why? They want to know. Why are you making this creature, this Bani Adam, this Adam? They are curious. Another example of the curiosity. We recite all the time in Hadith al-Kisa. Once they are all under the Kisa, the Ma'sumin, the punch tongue, the luminosity, the brightness is seen in the heavens. So what happens? What does the angel ask Allah Azza wa Jal? وَمَنْ تَحْتَ الْكِسَى. We see something very bright. We see something shining. Shining usually is in the heavens, in the stars. What is this shining on earth? What is it? وَمَنْ تَحْتَ الْكِسَى. They want to know. So angels have curiosity. They have aql. But now, an even more difficult question. Do they have free will or not? Aql they have. Do they have free will or not? Here, the reason we are asking this question is because in this part of the khutbah, Imam Ali said, فَاخْتَبَرَ مَلَائِكَتَهُ. He tested his angels. Why? ليميز المتواضعين منهم من المستكبرين. So that he could distinguish the humble from the arrogant. Allahu Akbar. None of this would make any sense if you say they don't have any free will. Would it make sense testing somebody who doesn't have free will? How can you test somebody who doesn't have free will? Does it make sense that you want to distinguish those who are humble from those who are arrogant? How can it make sense if they don't have free will on the one side? And of course, you know, this discussion is very closely linked to the discussion of Futros, that angel Futros, you know. Whenever we come to the birth anniversary of our third Imam, Aba Abdullah al-Husayn, salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi. We find that there is a very beautiful hadith that has been narrated about this angel Futros, whose wings were taken away because of something he did. He delayed in one of the commandments that Allah had given him. So the wings were taken away. He came and he wiped his body on the cradle of Aba Abdullah and he was blessed with the wings. So it is related to this question. Do angels have free will? You are telling me yes. I did not say yes. This is what we can gain implicitly. But the Quran is explicit. The Quran says no. When the Quraysh and the Arabs were talking about the angels as the daughters of Allah, the verses that were revealed to repudiate their claim was بَلْ عِبَادٌ مُكْرَمُونَ. They are not daughters of Allah. Rather, they are honorable servants of Allah. لا يسبقونه بالقول وهم بأمره يعملون. They never go ahead of Allah. They never speak in the face of Allah. And they do whatever Allah commands. They do whatever Allah commands. Now, scholars have debated this question in many different ways. And they have provided many different answers. Some of them have gone into the tafsir of the verses. And they have tried to come up with a meaning that would give angels free will. Others have said, no, we have to re-examine these traditions because the Quran is explicit. Nothing that goes against the Quran can be accepted. So scholars have different views. But there is a very interesting way that we can resolve this and also the question of Iblis. Because Iblis, the Quran says, كان من الجن. He was from the jinn. Then how come now he is being punished for not doing sajda to Adam when it was the malaika who were being tested, not the jinn? So there is one answer that resolves all these problems in one go. And that is what some scholars have said, and they have said the word malaika or malak has two meanings. One, a specific meaning, and the other a general meaning. The specific meaning we know is angels, but the general meaning means all non-material entities that reside in the heavenly plane fall under the title of malaika. That means some of the jinn would also be malaika. Some of the other creatures that we don't know about are also under the malaika. To explain this better, let's look at the word animal. When you say animal, what do you think of? Think of all these animals that we have, wild animals, tame animals. But if you ask a biologist, he will tell you the human being is also an animal. If you ask a philosopher, he will say, حَيْوَانٌ ناطق, a speaking animal, a thinking animal. So human being is also an animal. If you take it in a very broad and general sense, the human being is also counted as part of the animal kingdom. But if you take it in a specific sense, you know that animals are these other creatures that we have. Similarly, malaika, if you take it in a general sense, then the jinn would also fall under the rubric of malaika. So here they are saying, therefore, some of the jinn, and this opinion is not new. Even At-Tabari has mentioned this opinion in the 4th century of the Hijrah. That this is one of the ways that we can resolve this problem of Allah testing the malaika. Meaning Allah tested all the heavenly creatures, all of them. All the non-material creatures who had free will. He tested them. And this is one possible way of resolving this problem. Not the only way, but one possible way. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. And finally, the third theme. And that is the theme of arrogance. It is through his arrogance, through his vanity, through his bigotry, that shaitan became shaitan. He was Iblis. We are talking about arrogance because the Imam mentions arrogance here. He says that Iblis was Imamul Muta'assibin, was Salaful Mustakbirin. He is the Imam of the arrogant ones, of the haughty ones, of the bigoted ones. So arrogance is something that is a satanic trait. It is a trait of shaitan. Not only that, he is the one who actually founded it. وَضَعَ أَسَاسَ الْكِبْرِ. He is the one who put the foundations of this arrogance. That means whoever is arrogant in this world is actually following in the footsteps of shaitan. And when we think about it, we realize that there is really no need for us to be arrogant, and there is no reason that is justifiable for arrogance. If we look at the human being and we look at how we are, how we have been created, what we do in this world. If a person just takes a few moments to think about this, they will realize that there is no place for arrogance. Not only that, the things for which we are arrogant, if we look at them, we find that it is completely unjustifiable. Sometimes we are arrogant because of wealth that Allah Azza wa Jal has given us. Sometimes we are arrogant because of children. We have, mashallah, so many children. They are so good. They are so clever. Allah Azza wa Jal has given you the children. Sometimes we are arrogant because of our handsomeness. Did you get to choose what you're going to look like before you came to this earth? No. And so, most of the reasons for which people are arrogant, if you look at them, you find that these are all unjustifiable. The issue of arrogance and humility will be addressed, inshallah, again in another part of this sermon. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
Hi everyone, this is John. Welcome back to another episode of our weekly show, The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will explore how people and government of India see and react to the normalization of relations with Israel.
The United Arab Emirates and Bahrain have formally established diplomatic relations with the Israeli regime in deals brokered and promulgated by the US President Donald Trump. Palestinians have decried the move as a grave betrayal to the people and cause of Palestine, saying that formalizing ties with the Zionist regime further undermines efforts to achieve self-determination. However, the American president says that there are several other Arab states that are willing to go public with their Israeli affairs.
Some Arab countries are formally normalizing their relations with Israel. Most Muslims around the world are against it, and there are regular protests against the move in numerous countries, whether the respective governments support it or not. Evidently, the Indian government supports it, which is quite against the common spirit of the majority of the people in the subcontinent, and not only the Muslims.
It's despicable, sad, condemnable, unfortunate, and whatever we can say about this relation between Arab and Israel is beyond words.
As far as Indian Muslims are concerned, they have already expressed their strong condemnation about the recent normalization of the ties between Israel and UAE.
If you talk about Indian perspective, not just the Indian Muslims, but the Indian people at large have been and will always be with the Palestinian cause and have always condemned Israel and its aggression.
U.S. President Donald Trump was the force behind the agreement for the UAE and Bahrain to establish normal diplomatic relations with Israel. The day after Trump announced the deal, UAE Foreign Minister Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan briefed Indian External Affairs Minister Subrahmanyam Jaishankar about the move in a telephone call that the minister really appreciated. The timing of the proclamation seems suspiciously beneficial for Trump's re-election, as both Israel and UAE want him back in the White House. Trump wants to sell the agreement as a diplomatic victory in his campaign and tries to brand it Abraham Accord, as Abraham was father of all three great faiths.
The agreement is a part of a broader re-election show by Trump and his administration, who earlier this year revealed the so-called Middle East peace plan, which was categorically rejected by the Palestinians as well as other countries of the region. Even if Trump loses the elections, UAE is not likely to face any major diplomatic repercussions, as the Democratic hopeful Joe Biden has also welcomed the deal, cluelessly calling it a historic step to bridge the deep divides of the Middle East.
Some Arab states of the Persian Gulf had already established covert ties with Israel, so why is now the time to risk and go public about them? The UAE and Bahrain are the third and fourth Arab state after Egypt and Jordan to have opened diplomatic lines. If Abu Dhabi and Manama do not face any serious consequences, the move may serve as a catalyst for other states to follow suit. Trump has even more re-election stunts on his list and is pushing more countries such as Sudan and Oman toward Israel. India's reaction to the agreement is not surprising, as all the three nations behind the move have become close partners of India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi government. Israel and India have enjoyed close relations in recent years, and Modi has also been able to cultivate strong relations with the UAE. India sees this as a potentially positive sign, as the normalization may create a more favorable political environment for its interests in the Middle East.
Now, to add more insight, we are joined by Mr. Vijay Prasad, who is a historian, journalist, and director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. He is also the author of the book Namaste Sharon, Hindutva and Sharonism under U.S. Hegemony. Mr. Prasad, welcome to the subcontinent. So, in the past few decades, there have been many reports exposing Arab-Israeli back-channel links. Why have they decided to formalize their relations now?
You see, now, and when you talk about Arab, you mean mainly the United Arab Emirates. And we need to understand that there is an increased tension between the UAE and Turkey over a range of issues. On the one side, their battle over Libya. On the other side, their battle over gas fields in the Eastern Mediterranean. Turkey and the UAE have been struggling with each other over certain resources and regions in the greater North African, West Asian region. I have a feeling that the UAE, seeking to get European and American backing for its project, essentially normalized with Israel as a way to curry favor and therefore to put pressure on Turkey. There's no way the UAE can confront Turkey directly. So this is a way to get diplomatic favor in Washington, D.C., perhaps in Paris and so on, and allow that pressure to be put on Turkey so that Turkey backs off in, you know, on the one side in Libya, and on the other side in the very important energy battles taking place in the Eastern Mediterranean.
Okay, you're focusing on UAE, but Bahrain has also normalized relations with Israel recently, and Oman is in the pipeline. And you're saying that India is supporting this move because it wants to put pressure on Turkey and gain favors from the US. So does the Indian government support the normalization of relations between Israel and Arab states?
It's hard to say whether the Indian government directly supports the normalization, because India, as you know, plays a double game here. On the one hand, India has normalized with Israel and started that process in 91-92. On the other hand, India is a little careful, even under the Narendra Modi government, of too direct statements regarding the issue of Palestine or Israel, so as not to jeopardize relations mainly with Saudi Arabia, because there's a feeling that Saudi Arabia, a big energy provider to India, might not like it if India is too much public about its support for Israel. So India generally keeps a sort of double game here and hasn't come out directly and said we support the UAE or we don't support the UAE. I mean, in that sense, silence on this is to India's benefit.
Now, Mr. Prasad, our team has collected global media coverages in this regard, and we would like you to take a look on that, and then we can continue with the question answer session.
Historic as this moment is, it's worth looking at the larger geopolitical forces at work here and the short-term and long-term calculations of the key players involved. In the Machiavellian world of the Middle East, nothing is as clear-cut as it first appears. That's why it's also important that India play its cards carefully as it comes to terms with a changing Middle East. The fog over the emerging realignments in the region has officially lifted. India's strategic partnership with Israel, Saudi Arabia, and UAE is a major pillar of India's relationship with the West Asian region. This partnership will be strengthened. With India's growing ties to the US, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and UAE, and ties with Iran and Turkey floundering over the Kashmir issue, the agreement will buttress Delhi's ties with the region.
Thank you for staying with us, Mr. Prasad, and welcome back to the audience as well. So, Mr. Prasad, you earlier said that India is playing a double game. How can the Indian government support the Palestinian cause and Israel at the same time? Isn't it hypocritical? How is it possible?
To support the Palestinian cause and to support Israel at the same time is simply not possible, because in a sense, the Israeli project is about the annihilation of the Palestinian project. So you can't support both, I'm afraid. In this case, one has to make a choice. And India has effectively chosen to stand with Israel in terms of the Israel colonization of the Palestinian people, their life and land and so on. India has made a choice, but it doesn't want to too publicly declare that choice, even though it's made the choice. You know, so there'll be some small gestures vis-a-vis the Palestinians. The Indians will go and say, we'll invest in some project in the Palestinian Authority and so on. Small gestures will be made. But by and large, I think India, like many of the Gulf Arab countries, have made their choice and they have decided to stand with Israel against the Palestinian people.
So you're saying that India has made a choice and sided with Israel. So has India abandoned its Gandhian values?
Time ago that Gandhi, Nehru and others made clear their support for the Palestinian people and the Palestinian cause. You know, that was the era of anti-colonialism and struggles, and in a sense what the Palestinians were facing, what they were struggling with, was the struggle of anti-colonialism. You know, they wanted to free themselves from colonialism. This lasts all the way out till the 1980s in India, this support for the anti-colonial struggle. Yasser Arafat, for instance, comes to Delhi in 1983, is met at the airport by Indira Gandhi, the prime minister. He says that she is my sister. I mean, you know, they were very close relations. The Palestinian Liberation Organization had an office in Delhi. But after India decided to normalize with the United States, actually first, it was told you have to normalize with Israel. And that is the big shift. When the Soviet Union collapses, it was catastrophic for non-aligned policy. It was catastrophic for third world solidarity. It was catastrophic for the Palestinians. I mean, the PLO went and surrendered essentially at Oslo. During the Oslo Accords, those agreements. So, you know, it's not just India that surrendered its support for the Palestinians, but the PLO also in some ways surrendered its own views at Oslo. And that was a sign of the times. And sadly, a new kind of international support for the Palestinian cause has not been properly built up. This is greatly lacking.
Out of more than 190 member states of the United Nations, nearly 140 recognize the state of Palestine, and about 160 also recognize Israel. This means a lot of the governments in the world have relations with both the occupier and the occupied. But when Arab countries connive with the US to establish former ties with the Zionist regime, many other countries feel emboldened to defend their Israeli ties.
India's official stand about Israel has always been somehow paradoxically, yet conveniently supple. In 2014, India chose to pursue a de-hyphenation policy aiming to deal with both Israel and Palestine in an independent manner. In 2017, India voted against recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, and then again in 2018, New Delhi decided to review its Palestine policy when the Palestinian ambassador to Pakistan was photographed, along with the chief of Lashkar-e-Taiba, a militant group blamed for the 2008 Mumbai siege. While Palestine calls this a betrayal that blows up every possibility for peace, India welcomes the full normalization of ties between UAE and Israel, calling both key strategic partners. New Delhi says it still continues its traditional support for the Palestinian cause. But how? It seems that the Middle East has more than enough sand for everybody to bury their heads in. Otherwise, the world would notice such inconsistent and constantly changing policies. Israel, UAE, and the US claim the normalization is an exchange of Tel Aviv suspending its annexation of Palestinian territories. But from the Palestinian point of view, the UAE and Bahrain have destroyed any hopes of establishing an independent state with this move that can never slow Israeli expansionism.
This step is very dangerous step because it will encourage some other countries in order to normalize their relation with Israel, which is not normal, which is against our religion, which is against our history.
Palestine belongs to the Arabs in the same sense that England belongs to the English or France to the French. This Mahatma Gandhi's 1938 remark about Palestine is the most quoted utterance in any literature of India's foreign policy. The first blow to Gandhian values was in 1992, when India reversed its four-decade-old policy of recognition without relations and normalized relations with the Israeli regime. Now, with India's support for the normalization of ties with Israel, Gandhi's statement that Palestine belongs to the Arabs is further losing its relevance.
Several pundits believe it is not surprising, not even a big deal, that a number of Arab countries are going public with their previously covert ties with Israel, as some others, including India, stand and applaud. Formalized relations with Israel probably guarantee garnering bipartisan favor with the United States. And the U.S. approval means a green light for authoritarian governments to suppress all different voices and domestic challenges with less chance of international pressure. Thanks to formalizing relations with Israel, Bahrain's Al Khalifa family have acquired an influential ally in its fight against domestic opposition. This can also be true for Saudi Arabia, which is still gauging the prospects of normalization, since Riyadh seeks to nip the bud for political liberalization that would challenge the legitimacy of the ruling Al-Saud monarchy, including demands for change from its own repressed Shia minority. The Indian government longs for such an opportunity. India has compelling reasons to feel optimistically comfortable, but its open support for Israeli relations may put its own interests and dealings at stake in the Middle East. If New Delhi puts all its eggs in the Arab basket, Islamabad may align itself more closely with Tehran and Ankara, all in the backdrop of growing Iran-China and Pakistan-Iran ties.
For more analysis, we are now joined by Dr. Tasleem Ahmed Rahmani, who is the President of Muslim Political Council of India and the National Secretary of Social Democratic Party of India. Dr. Rahmani, welcome to the show. So, how do the Indian people, especially the 200 million Muslims, view these Arab countries formalizing ties with Israel?
You see, the Indian Muslims are traditionally and historically against the Israel and with standing always with the Palestinian cause. Still, the general public, and there is no change in their stand, in their policy towards Palestine and towards Israel. We have always taken Israel as a traitor country, as an occupier, and as a terrorist state. And we still, at our public level, general public level, we still owe that stand, and very vociferously. We are here to boycott the Israeli product, and our union government still towards the pro-Israeli policy is being strongly condemned by the Indian Muslims because we take it as an occupier.
Okay, so you're saying that people side with the Palestinian cause and condemn the support of the Indian government for Israel. India has strong economic ties with Arab countries. Do you see this as a weight on the Indian government to support Arab normalization with Israel?
Yes, indeed. you see the change in India. It's a fascist regime. We always termed it as a fascist regime, as a saffronized and a right-wing, a radicalized political party is the BJP. And after the BJP has taken over, they have just opened up their relationship with Israel. Most of our security installations, our business ties, economic ties, agriculture sector, power sector, telecommunication sector, the government of India has a big tie-up with the Israeli government. And ideologically, this BJP, RSS, and Israel policy has an affinity in they stand at the same pedestal. That's why this strong bonding between India and Israel has repercussions on the Indo-Arab relationship. So as far as the Arab countries are coming closer to Israel, the India is also becoming closer to those Muslim countries or Arab countries which are coming closer to Israel. That's why they praise UAE, they praise Saudi Arab, some of such Gulf countries. While this is a fact that our relationship, as far as our foreign policy is concerned, our relation with Saudi Arab was not very cordial. It was just a normal relationship we always maintained with Saudi Arab and other such Gulf countries. But after this change in regime and the shift in foreign policy, these relationship has become more cordial, just because of the relationship with Israel are coming more, the diplomatic relation is coming more closer with those Gulf rulers. That's obviously the government of India has taken a step towards them, and they have made their bonding much more stronger just because of Israel.
Now, Dr. Rahmani, let's just quickly take a look at how global media has covered this issue, and then we can continue with the question.
In late November 2019, there was widespread outrage over a video of the Indian Consul General in New York, Sandeep Chakravorty, in which he suggested to a gathering of Kashmiri Hindus that India should follow the Israeli model and build settlements in the Kashmir Valley to secure the return of Hindus. Kashmiri activists and journalists were shocked by his apparent support for Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories. But this is only one of many recent examples of a growing political love affair between India and Israel. Retired Indian Foreign Service officer Navdeep Suri, who had been India's ambassador to UAE until late 2019, has told The Wire that the trends towards the normalization of ties between Israel and UAE had been clearly discernible in the last couple of years, as the two were driven by their joint antipathy towards Iran.
All right, Dr. Rahmani, welcome back to the show. So you're saying that the Indian government loves Israel and is therefore supporting the Arab countries who are formalizing their relations with the Israeli regime. India has a history of supporting Palestinian cause. Has anything changed there in India with this regard?
You see, Gandhian values, Gandhi, Congress and Muslims and so many other groups like the liberals, communists, social organizations, they were always pro-Palestine, pro-Gandhian. This regime, and particularly this ideology, RSS pose, they claim today that they are actually the Gandhian. While they do not belong to Gandhi or Gandhi philosophy, they are actually the killers of Gandhi, and not only the killer of Gandhi, they are the killer of Gandhian ideology. But because Gandhi is a tallest icon in our nation, and no regime can go further without taking the name of Gandhi. That's why the present establishment try to show that they are also Gandhian, and that's why otherwise they have nothing to do with Gandhi or Gandhi philosophy actually. That so there is a shift in the Israel and Palestine policy, but that doesn't mean that the Gandhi or Gandhi ideology has tilted towards that policy. This is a fraud and this is a farce that this RSS and BJP try to pose that they are also Gandhian. No, they are not Gandhians. they take advantage